Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my drinking buddies, there's Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And there is Danny, king of the humans, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey, it's good to be here on Earth.
Excellent. So, we are here today.
I think you should always introduce yourself.
It's great to be here on Earth.
Yeah.
We are here today to talk about the newest film from writer-director Edgar Wright, starring Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, Martin Freeman, Paddy Considine, and, oh, can I remember his name?
Eddie Marsden. Yes. And Rosamund Pike.
And Rosamund Pike, for 5 minutes. This is The World's End. And it is out in theaters now. Before we get into that, anyone who's listened before should know that we have a discussion topic before we get into the main review. Today we will be talking about the other films in the Cornetto trilogy, alternately known as the Blood and Ice Cream trilogy. That would be Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. And I guess we might have reason to speak briefly about the abomination that is Scott Pilgrim.
Okay.
Ooh.
Right, a week after you praise Ain't Them Body Saints, right? Okay.
Okay, hold on. Are we really doing this? Are we really doing this?
You're
going to claim that that's a better film than Ain't Them Body Saints?
It is a much better film
than Ain't Them Body Saints. Okay, all right. Everybody,
this is going to be stunning.
For the SmackDown to end all SmackDowns, get ready. It's going to be blood and ice cream all over the floor. So, before we get into that, just a couple of announcements. Once again, thank you to everyone who has been listening and commenting on the film stage. And I'd like to thank whoever gave us a 5-star review and called us smart and funny on iTunes. If you disagree with him, maybe you should go to iTunes and leave us a comment and a rating. If you agree with him, though, I'd much prefer that you go to iTunes and give us a comment and a rating. But either way, just let us know how we're doing. And you can always email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So that's it. Before we get into the main topic, which is going to be, as I said, about the Cornetto trilogy and the other work of Edgar Wright, I want to have a quick mention of the fact that Twitter was rocked to its very core this week, and fandom exploded because we now know that the new Batman is going to be Ben Affleck, Academy Award winner. For what? Writing and Best Picture, but not director for some reason. So, yeah, people were kind of two minds about this. There were those who thought it was a good idea and those who thought it was a terrible idea. So, in the name of joining the zeitgeist, let's give our opinions on this. So, Nick, what are your thoughts on Ben Affleck as Batman fighting Henry Cavill as Superman? And Danny, retort.
Well, I mean, actually, when I first heard the news on Twitter, I passed out just from overwhelming excitement and hate at the news. And I just woke up 5 minutes ago. So I really haven't had a lot of time to process this news because it is so big and it is so masterful that I'm just going to need a little longer to process it.
Yeah, here's the thing. A lot of people kept bringing up Daredevil, and apparently their belief was that Ben Affleck had already had a shot at being a superhero and he'd failed. I don't know how I feel about that, because I feel like if we just gave up on people immediately upon one bad performance, then we wouldn't have any actors ever, anywhere. And I also like to point out that Chris Evans was in the execrable Fantastic Four film, but he was pretty damn awesome as Captain America. So everybody calm down. I personally actually am still not sure how I feel about Ben Affleck being Batman. Because I just don't see him as like a brawler. That's... I just like, you know, Christian Bale, like, yeah, he cuts like the figure of a businessman and he can play like shrewd and stupid and drunk and buffoon. But like, I still feel like he could beat the crap out of me. And I just feel like Ben Affleck, I guess, you know, he's going to have to bulk up or something, but he seems very slight know what I mean?
Especially now that he like won Best Picture, like he's just on top of everything. Like he's not, he doesn't need to fight anyone. Like he'll just show them his Oscar and be like, "Yeah, I'm gonna go direct another movie."
It is also weird. Yeah, like I mean, it's a weird career path to take after. You know, I mean, when you win a Oscar for Best Picture, I feel like that's you've resuscitated your career. You're in a healthy place. You don't really need the superhero thing. And it just seems weird that such an established guy would break into it like that. So yeah.
Yeah, I think like my interest in the announcement is more like what his logic was than how the movie will turn out, because there's still, you know, I'm sure they don't really even have a script yet, so there's no way to even really talk about that yet.
Yeah. And you make a good point. They don't really have a script yet, and yet it'll be out in 2 years. So we'll see how that goes. That's about it. Nick, any other thoughts before we move on?
I'm sure he'll be fine. I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be fine. It's just a weird, it's very weird. I don't quite get it. I'm cautiously optimistic.
Well, they said that they're looking for an older, more seasoned person, because it's, you know, they want like a man. So, not a boy. Sure. Yeah, I don't care. I'm so apathetic about this news. Like, I really don't have anything to say.
I think it would have been great if they'd gotten, like, Nick Nolte to do it.
Wow.
He basically already has a Batman voice.
Well, they said that they're going to base it on... it's going to take a lot of inspiration from The Dark Knight Returns, mm-hmm. which is the classic Frank Miller comic book where Batman is something like 60 years old in a dystopian Reagan-run militaristic America. It's a great comic book if you haven't read it. And for that, Nick Nolte would actually be perfect if he's grizzled and old and his bones creak. But, I mean, I don't think Ben Affleck's bones creak.
No. And that's the thing, like, they say they want an older guy. I don't think old when I think Ben Affleck.
No, but he's 41. So, you know, he's not, you know, like Ryan Reynolds or something.
So he's, like, maybe 3 years older than Christian Bale was supposed to be in the last film?
Yeah, but...
Okay.
The point is that they're looking... I mean, Henry Cavill, I don't think is very old, is he?
I am not sure how old Henry Cavill is. Are you looking that up now?
Yeah, let's see. He's 30. So there's an age difference there.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah.
No. All right. Anyway, so that's that. That's our thoughts on it. It's definitely made me more interested in the film than when I heard about it previously. Like, if they had just gotten another pretty face, I guess, to go up against Henry Cavill's pretty face, I wouldn't have been interested. But the fact that they went for Ben Affleck and that he took it, that says something to me. And I'm not sure what. So that's that. We can move on. Let's talk about Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, and the Cornetto trilogy. This got kickstarted with the sleeper hit Shaun of the Dead, moved on with the riotously funny Hot Fuzz, and it concludes this weekend with The World's End. So let's talk about our thoughts on these films, see where we walked into The World's End and how we walked out of it later on. So Nick Newman, why don't you kick us off? Tell us what you think about this trilogy of movies. And then once we get through those, we can talk briefly about Scott Pilgrim.
Okay. So the thing about the... if you've listened to the show in the past, when we've talked about these movies, which I don't think is very often, but on the occasion when we've talked about them, I've expressed my huge fandom for these movies. And it's kind of hard to... If you've never seen them, and if I just describe them, you might wonder why I think they're such great works. And the reason, a big reason for that is Edgar Wright himself, who I've come to think is the best living comedy filmmaker. In fact, I don't think it's even close as to who is actually, just purely as a filmmaker, as someone who is creating these works. I can't think of anybody who is quite at his level right now when it comes to the realm of comedy. And that's because his movies...
I mean, I can't even come up with a guy who I could possibly say was near him.
Mm-hmm. Because his movies are... They're actual films. They actually have this visual dynamism to them. And I think of something like Judd Apatow, whose movies I enjoy, right. Surely. They're funny, they're entertaining. But they're not exactly they're not really something that you can really sink into in terms of the way they're shot and they're edited and the way that they kind of refract off of each other. These are movies that I think kind of do something for comedy that hasn't really been done for decades. I don't think that people have been treating the genre with as much seriousness, which is with as much respect and effort as him in quite some time. And that's very exciting. But on top of that, the movies are these really fun, really personal sort of explorations of what exactly entertain people, what make them tick, what make them drive, which is sort of carried through with, you have Shaun of the Dead, which is the zombie genre, you have Hot Fuzz, which is action films, and then you have The World's End, which is science fiction. And the way they kind of put their characters into them and the way that they make them part of the action, in part because they've grown up on things relating to these very subjects, which kind of adds to this quality of what I was saying before. There's this personal quality to it that I think pretty much most other genre pastiches don't have. Most of them are kind of pointing and laughing at them. These are actually paying respect and showing a love for this kind of thing. So it's very exciting what these movies do, and I'm very glad to see it brought to its endpoints now this weekend in The World's End. Right. So,
Danny King, thoughts?
Yeah, I would have to echo a lot of what Nick was saying. This week was actually my first time seeing Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz.
What?
Both of which
that's actually
were released.
Surprising.
Yeah, wait, how did
that
happen?
They were both released and seen several years ago, you know? certainly in past years.
Well, where the hell
past
were you?
apparently not at the theater for these films. I don't know. I don't know what happened. But
had you, like, known about them? Or,
Yeah, I think I didn't. I didn't know enough about them at the time. And then kind of when... One of the things for me about, like, thematic trilogies is if I don't know enough about them, sometimes I'm confused, like, what order I should watch them in, or if there's, like, a right way to watch them. So I think I never felt like I settled into, like, a proper opportunity to view them. But, you know, this week, because of time, I was just like, all right, fuck it. I'll, you know, watch them. but, I really like them. One thing that sort of all of his movies so far kind of fall into a pattern for me is that I adore like the first hour of them. And then because he kind of, for all of his unique invention, he does kind of abide by classical screenwriting structure for the most part.
Yeah.
So once his movies sort of get into these action climaxes, it's almost like an automatic downturn in quality for me, because what he does, as Nick said, what he does with visual comedy and combining just really brilliant writing with visual jokes and gags is so unique and original that there's almost no action sequence that he could shoot that would be more exciting. He could be doing Gravity and it wouldn't be as unique. So like there's sort of like a bit of a downturn in the second half of his films. It'll be interesting if he continues to sort of play with genre in this way, where like the first half of his movies are all kind of like dialogue driven, setting up the characters. And then he sort of goes into spoof the genre, because it's a really cool structure, but I wonder if he'll move past it. And you could probably argue that he does a little bit at the end of The World's End, which we could talk about later. But yeah, right now I'm just sort of curious to see where his career goes from here now that the trilogy has wrapped up. But I do share Nick's enthusiasm for the man's talent.
Yeah, I guess I've already kind of said it. I agree with Nick about his singularity in terms of being a comedy director. I also heavily agree with you, Danny, about his kind of classical storytelling structure and the way that it tends to drag things down, I guess, towards the end. I've really enjoyed all three of these films, and I guess my one thing to add is that I just sometimes have a problem with the way that it doesn't encourage certain characters to grow in healthy ways. Like, there's, I got a real issue watching Shaun of the Dead, because I openly hate Nick Frost's character in that film. And I think that in any world in which this was an actual thing that was happening, he would have been shot in the face. Like, there's no... I understand, like, you know, mates are mates and you gotta hang on to your friends and everything. And that's kind of the point of the movie is, you know, this friendship is unbreakable. But at the same time, like, there's a problem with me and dealing with someone like that. And just the way that the movie doesn't ever force a change.
I mean, there is actually a big change for him, but...
I mean, does that count?
I would say so. I mean, I don't know. Is there anybody who doesn't know the ending of Shaun of the Dead at this point?
I was about to say, we could probably throw, I guess, spoilers, right? I mean, like,
right.
If you haven't seen it yet, you should see it.
If you're a regular Danny King over here...
Yeah, I was going to say, a week ago, if I listened to this, I would have sent an angry email.
Okay, well, yeah, spoilers, we're gonna talk about the end of some of these films, but, you know, now you have a basic idea of what we think of it. So, yeah, let's talk about it. I mean, he turns into a goddamn zombie. Like, that's it? And, like, the thing is, and it we'll get into it in The World's End, but, I mean, like, that's just the kind of way that these films are. Like, they almost reward the worst impulses of their protagonists. Like, at the end of Shaun of the Dead... Nick Frost gets turned into a zombie, and he gets to be chained up and play Xbox all the time, which is, like, the only thing that he ever really wanted to do anyway.
Although you do have to wonder, you know, you do have to wonder a bit how ideal an existence that really is.
I mean, I'm sure it's not, but then that's kind of the other thing. Like, you have Simon Pegg's character in that, Sean, and he is keeping his friend, who is in an undead state, and constantly wants to eat people, chained up to be his, like, personal video game slave.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a cute idea, and, like, at the end of all these films, I guess not Hot Fuzz so much, because I can't really see...
I was actually about to say... Actually, I was going to say, what about the ending of Hot Fuzz, where they turn into fascists who are completely controlling a town, and they're basically taking up the mantle of the people they... They basically destroyed a town to get rid of this group, and they're taking up their mantle... In a way, which is, I mean, I don't know. It's a sort of a fuck yeah ending when it, you know, they speed off and everything. But it's also, if you think about it for like 10 seconds, it's also a bit disturbing too.
Yeah.
So
and that's the thing. Like, it's a, like, the, one of the things I like most about these films is that they do have ideas. Like, there are plots at the bottom of these, and they have things to say about humanity and friendship and love and, that's great, but at the same time, the conclusion that they come to is almost universally bad. And I know it's a comedy, and that's fine, but it's almost like with Elysium. Like, I could get over a stupid film, but I can't get over a stupid smart film. And so with these films, like, I can't forgive so much the things that they're saying at the end of the day, because they are trying. Like, they put thought into it. It's not like an unfortunate consequence of, like, bad screenwriting. Like, that's what they want to say, and I don't know that I agree with it ever.
Mm. Right. I do sort of like the... I don't know. I guess I feel that strange, sort of slightly ambiguous ending kind of plays into much of the movie, which is about sort of paying respects to these sort of forefathers of genre and kind of putting it under a new lens, even as, like I said, the ending of Hot Fuzz is... you know, really exciting and cool, but then it's also sort of not, sort of morally not cool. And so that's what I like about it, is how it is kind of shuffling you out of the theater as things are kind of going back to a certain status quo. I mean, the ending of Shaun of the Dead, too, it's not just that Nick Frost has become like a video game slave, it's that people are using zombies now. You know, they used to be people, now they're using them for game shows and you know, service work and everything like that, so everybody can live happier.
It's like if someone embalmed your grandma once she died and then was using her in like a theme park.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's like messed up. Like, it's weird.
It is weird, and I think that I do think there is sort of a cultural thing there where I think that in the United States, sort of kind of an ending like that might be seen as less acceptable because it's not because there isn't sort of like a there isn't really a cherry on top in a way. Whereas in England, you know, a lot of British cinema that I've encountered kind of has darker, more morally ambiguous conclusions. That's it seems like to me like an English way of storytelling. And so I like that there's sort of that cultural, I don't want to say stigma, but there is that cultural differentiation which comes with it, which doesn't mean people have to like it, but right. I do find that quite funny. And then I'm still, you know, when I saw The World's End, when I saw it last month, I thought that the ending was really dark, but I saw it again yesterday, and I'm still actually, now I'm not 100% sure, but I do know that it's not... It's still not a happy ending.
Like, no, it's not.
Even if it's not necessarily dark, it's not happy at all. And yeah, I mean, so I think that I think it's also about kind of growing with these films a bit too, and sort of seeing where they, sort of seeing how you feel about them in a couple of years' time. Because, you know, I mean, Shaun of the Dead is 9 years old and Hot Fuzz is 6 and The World's End is like a month at most. So I'm hoping to see like kind of where, how I feel about that aspect of it in the years to come.
Yeah. Danny, any thoughts on these? I mean, I know that haven't had enough time, as much time as us to stew.
Yeah.
Over, but I mean, did that affect you when you were watching them?
The cultural aspect?
The dark and weird way that they end. Like, each of these movies creates a world that is estimably worse than the world that began.
Yeah. I mean, it is odd, and it could be a cultural thing, because if you... Judging by the surface tone of each ending, they are very much, like, cherry-on-top endings. But like Nick said, once you think about them for, like, 5 or 10 seconds, they become a little darker. And The World's End is almost like just a total deconstruction of what a movie ending can be. Like, that takes it to another level. But one thing about his movies, and I sort of mentioned this a little earlier, but is kind of like how long they wait to become genre movies. Like, you can tell he has invested a lot in setting up the characters. And I was curious because, like, a lot of the World's End reviews I read made a point of not mentioning the genre elements in that film, mm-hmm. because there's so much of the film that comes before that. And I almost wondered if, like, critics who screened this film, and I don't know, Nick, if you were, but I wonder if Focus Features, like, told them to keep that out of their review.
I have a tidbit about that.
Oh.
Would anybody
hear? Okay.
Yeah, tell us.
So
yeah.
When I went to the screening, you know, if you've been to a press screening, usually the publicist is there and they hand you press notes. They also handed me this slip of paper, which I didn't really have time to look at. I just sort of took it and then I went in. And actually, if you give me a second, I can read it.
Okay.
Let me just grab it here from my closet.
What secrets dwell in the closet of Nick Newman?
Oh, God.
Dun, dun, dun.
So this is a note from Edgar Wright.
Okay.
I'm going to read it.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming along to the screening. We would love the audience to experience this film as you do and would really appreciate if you didn't reveal some of the surprises, twists, and actors that do not feature in the trailers. Forgive me for asking, as I know you would never dream of doing such a dastardly thing. Thanks for your cooperation, and I hope you enjoy the movie.
Yeah, they didn't, they didn't give that to me when I went to mine.
I don't know, maybe because mine was early, or... I don't know, because it was before it was out in the UK, so I think maybe... I think once it was out in the UK, it kind of... Sort of the cat was out of the bag a bit.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's a note that I got, which I thought was kind of neat. And it was surprising, too, because I guess I feel like, with a few exceptions in terms of actors who appear and maybe a couple of ways the story goes, I feel like there isn't maybe, I don't know. I mean, I'm not really sure who didn't know this wasn't, like, a sci-fi movie. People who were excited for it, I mean, it's kind of been said for years now that this would be sci-fi. So, yeah, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, it does. Cool. It does feel like an interesting case for me in terms of like a movie telling reviewers not to spoil, because I mean, like, I've seen the trailer for this movie just before other films like 10 times. So it was like, it was just, I felt it was like common knowledge. So to like come across reviews that were sort of
like playing with it.
Yeah, that was interesting. And it feels like it's been a while since that happened. But the other point on top of that was like, I feel like the previous two films in this trilogy, both, are equally kind of resistant to becoming genre movies right away. They sort of, it takes a while. I mean, Shaun of the Dead is pretty clever in the way it like put zombies in the frame, but for like the first half hour or so before going to like a full zombie movie. So you can probably foreshadow it like 15 or 20 minutes in. But for the most part, the first 45 minutes or so are just like dialogue driven, like character stuff. And Hot Fuzz doesn't even really become a buddy movie until maybe like an hour in or something.
Yeah. So that's our thoughts on the Cornetto trilogy, alternately known as the Blood and Ice Cream trilogy. These aren't on Netflix, so I don't, I guess, go buy.
You can rent the disc.
You can rent the disc. Who does that anymore?
I do.
You do. Of course you do.
Why wouldn't I get discs?
I'm joking. I still get discs too.
Anyway. I was going to say, like, such a richer quantity of films via disc. Come on.
It's true. All right, so let's move on. We've already talked about it a little bit. The World's End, the newest film by Edgar Wright, written by Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright, starring Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, Martin Freeman, Eddie Marsan, Patty Considine, Rosamund Pike.
Let's do this!
They haven't seen each other in 20 years.
I'm free to do what I want.
But tonight, they're returning to their hometown to finish the ultimate pub crawl.
This is our chance to finally conquer the Golden Mile.
12 pubs, 12 pints.
And this time, they're going to make it to the last pub, the World's End.
Let's go! I'm free.
Okay, so this is a film about five friends who go back to their childhood town with the stated purpose of completing a pub crawl known as the Golden Mile. It is 12 pubs, 12 pubs, 12 pints, and you get to the end and it's the World's End, which actually is a pretty damn awesome name for a pub, and I wish that DC could name bars like that instead of just like Love. It's awful. Anyway,
is that like a sex club?
No. That's the thing, like, okay, so this is again, this actually plays into the movie, because one of the things I liked about it was that it really gave you a sense of place, and it made me feel the affection for all of these places that these characters did, with names like The World's End, The Familiar Companion, things like that. It's awesome. I love that. And in DC, it's like two clubs, they're called alternately Love and Fur. Like, what kind of a name is that?
It's really DC. Hip. A lot of dance music.
Probably. And then there's, what is it, Lotus, which is just obvious. It's, I don't know. But so that's my first thoughts on the movie. Let's talk about The World's End. Danny King, as the newest one to come to this trilogy, and as the man whose last name is King, why don't you start us off?
Well, you know, you mentioned the last name, and I felt a real personal connection with Gary King, just in terms of my personal character and life experience. But we can leave that for an extra episode.
Alright.
Yeah, no, that was
it. It's all your
bad
thoughts.
Joke. So yeah, The World's End, totally in love with the first 45 minutes or an hour. This is a theme of me with Edgar Wright's movies. But kind of like the one word that a lot of people have used to describe this film is like melancholy. And I feel that the beginning of this film really hits that home so well, that the movie kind of peaks early on. I think that it has the opening voiceover narration and montage of like the group of friends' first attempt at the pub crawl. And there's Simon Pegg's voiceover. And then the first cut to Simon Pegg's face, where he's in like a clinic or an AA thing, is really shocking, not just because of where he is, but because Simon Pegg actually looks kind of old in the shot, not objectively, but compared to like some of the previous work he did, especially because I just watched like Hot Fuzz probably a couple hours before. But it was like shocking to me how worn down he looked. And that shot hit me right away. And then you go into these interactions where he's talking with old friends, all of whom are clearly pretty established in their jobs and kind of confident, respectable people. And he's just like this mess. And it's very funny, but it does nail that sadness so well. Going into the kind of second half of the film, I'm still really kind of grappling with where this movie goes, because I feel like out of the Cornetto trilogy, this probably has certainly the strangest ending, and also the one that has a lot of mixed signals that I don't really know how to make sense of yet, so I'm hoping you guys can help me. But overall, I would say I really like the film. It's still in this pattern with me for Edgar Wright, where the genre stuff to me isn't as exciting as the character building and the dialogue. But I'll definitely take it over a lot of the other stuff we've seen. So,
all right, Nick Newman, what about yourself?
I like it. Like it a lot. That's my review.
This is why you get paid the big bucks.
Yeah. So I was going to say, really have to echo Danny discussing how I'm going to say this movie, like, just in for lack of a better term, this movie depressed the shit out of me, and I really wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
Because these movies are and still are so funny and so energetic and you know, are so propulsive that I kind of wasn't expecting to spend the next few days sort of reflecting on my own life because of this movie. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, I have to say, as someone who, you know, is in college right now and is home for the summer, and kind of has that awkward sort of get back together with friends thing, this movie completely and totally nails sort of that trepidation about sort of going back to your past and sort of trying to get back to what made it good, or sort of playing to that gilded memory of what made it good. And there is I feel like, you know, I completely understand what this movie is saying about, you know, the whole danger of trying to recapture your better times. And on top of that, though, the movie is, again, like every Edgar Wright film, it's impeccably crafted and it's very tightly written and it's very funny. And, you know, I had a great time with it. But at the same time, I've seen it twice and I almost kind of never want to see it again because of the way the movie makes me feel, which is weird. It's very strange to say that, but I think that this... I don't know. I mean, I can't remember the last film I saw that I sort of had that kind of connection to. I don't know, maybe The Spectacular Now will do that for me or something. Maybe. But yeah, on top of that, just to sort of get more into sort of the other media aspects of it, I do think that maybe this is probably the, I don't want to say the weakest of the trilogy, but it's sort of the least enthusiastic about humanity and life. So I do think that it kind of, there's sort of a purposeful sense of a come down to it where you're kind of, you know, in your 40s and you almost can't be indulging in this sort of thing anymore, which is kind of what the movie's playing toward, where I feel like very wisely, a lot of it is about how they kind of don't really have the time or energy for this to deal with an alien invasion. And so, you know, it's not only very fun, but it's also very wise about playing against sort of the mold of its previous entries while also becoming a part of it as well. One last thing I've sort of said before, tell me if I'm crazy. I feel like this is sort of the Before Midnight of the Cornetto series, which is a weird comparison because Before Midnight is only a few months old, but it is sort of what I do think of in relation to it. So, yeah. Anyway, The World's End, I think it's great, but it's also very depressing. So, yay.
Yeah, it is a depressing film towards the end. I would say if I could watch this movie and excise the last 2 or 3 minutes, I would be 100% enthusiastic about it. I thought that the characters were really well done. Again, you know, Edgar Wright and his direction, I mean, just what he does with a camera, his editing, everything that the man does is great. And this movie is hilarious, and I need to see it again just because I'm pretty sure I probably missed a bunch of jokes because we were still laughing from all the other stuff that was going on. And you just become enthralled with it. It's smart. It's got a sense of humanity and people and growing old and the way that our past affects us that is very... It's acute in a way that a lot of actual dramas that are trying to do that somehow fail to be. And I love all the actors in it. It's hilarious from start to almost the finish. But that... And we'll get into it in spoilers, but that last 3 or 4 minutes or however long it is, it really, 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 really affects the way that I look back on the rest of the film in retrospect. Like,
yeah,
I
read your review and it was pretty much like written through the lens of that, like, final 2 or 3 minutes.
Like, yeah, because it's not like one bad line. It's not like the he's kind of hot at the end of Superman, the Man of Steel. Like, it is a thing which then makes you retroactively look at everything else that the movie was doing up until that point and say, but what happened? Which sucks, because again, like, I'm enthusiastically, unabashedly in love with most of this film. And I wish that I could understand what they thought they were doing at the end there. And I was actually at a screening that had a Q&A with them at the end. And so I understand what they thought they were trying to do, because they literally told me, but I just don't think that it really comes off the way that they want it to. And that's a problem for me. It's a real big problem for me, which sucks, because at work, I've begun placing movie grades on a sheet of paper that I put on the edge of my cubicle. So people,
is this film a question mark?
Isn't
it ellipses?
I want to be like A plus, crashing down into like a C, which then levels out to like a B plus. It's just I really can't wrap my head around it, because I like it, except for the end, and the end destroys a lot of what I liked about it previously, which is insane. But I mean, outside of that, I mean, like, the fight choreography is kinetic and interesting, and it's always changing. It's not a film where you really feel bogged down in it. The humor is really intelligent and smart, but also it can be stupid at times, but like stupid in a smart way. There's so much good in there. And for it to poison itself, it's just insanity.
All right, well, let's not make it the fulcrum of our discussion.
Okay. I mean, but it kind of has to be for me. Like, that's...
I mean, there are other things. There are a lot of other... aspects of this movie which are worth chatting about.
All right, well, throw some out there, we'll get into those, and then when we get into spoilers we can talk more about the ending.
Okay, obviously. So one thing I want to say is how I was a bit worried initially when they sort of announced the cast for the movie. Not it's a great cast, but the first two movies, although they also have strong performers, are much more centrally about Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Right.
But this is more an ensemble piece, and I was worried, how are they going to balance that, and B, will it affect the relationship, which is always at the center of these other movies? And then I was very relieved to see the film, and I guess it was sort of silly to worry about in the first place, because it's, you know, Martin Freeman, Patty Considine, and Eddie Marson, all of whom are very, very funny, and they're quite funny together. And it was surprising to see... entire scenes dedicated to just them talking,
mm-hmm.
while Peg and Frost are actually off screen. And I didn't feel as if I was watching something from a different series. It still felt very much in tune with what had come before. And that was kind of weird, but I guess much of that comes down to, well, of course, it comes down to the writing and the talent of the performers. But this movie just has such a strong cast from basically one end of the spectrum, from the biggest role to the very smallest. There's a certain actor, a certain British actor who appears in the movie in a relatively prominent role. If you've seen Hot Fuzz, there is sort of a connection there with who he is. I'll just say that. But the way he... Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, well done. I like
it. So that's really great. And then you have a lot of the members of who kind of had smaller roles in the previous Cornetto films. And then you even have actors from Spaced, too. Michael Smiley shows up as a sort of like a well-dressed drug dealer. There's the actor who played Brian, who's kind of an overly friendly bartender. I think Julia Deakin even shows up as well. So that was really, really quite a pleasure to luxuriate in. It's sort of what buoys the movie through. It's sort of what elevates it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to agree. I was going to say, it's weird because I feel like, and I think Danny touched on this a little bit, it's just, we're talking about all this and we're not even really focusing on the fact that, like, robots are replacing people in this town.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels that weird is, because, yeah, and, like, when I was writing my review, I was like, oh, yeah, there are robots. But, like, that's not important. And there were points during the movie where I almost wondered about that. Because it's, like, it's the point of the movie. Like, that is a huge plot point. But at the same time, it almost feels like it could not have been there. Mm-hmm. And it still would have been quite fantastic, especially because they spend so much time not dealing with the fact that there are robots in the town. Like, did anyone else feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Danny, I know, yeah, I was going to say, I know that
it is a little strange because not only are they the, like, the surface level kind of genre entertainment part of the movie, but they also have a very clear... metaphorical significance for what the narrative situation is and the thematic situation. But I sort of agree that, like, after the first sort of blue blood scene, it's kind of like, okay, I get that this is the genre the movie's working with and I get what they represent thematically. But now, a couple of days removed from the movie, like you said, mostly what I'm kind of thinking about are the characters and stuff that become stuff that comes before and after but to me that's also something I felt during the other two films of the trilogy, and so I feel like that's just something he likes to do, is to like work through these issues through genre. And so it would be interesting for him to make a movie that doesn't do that, just to see how different it would play. Because it's easy to say, like, oh, the first 45 minutes of this movie were so good, just as dialogue. Why don't you just go ahead and make a whole movie like that? But at the same time, it feels like he does like working these things through physical action and set pieces, and that kind of liberates him in a lot of ways. So it would be interesting to sort of see him do that in the future and see how it plays out.
Although I do think it is maybe in some ways the least interesting play with genre of the series, I will say that one thing that kind of makes it the most important, it's not only that thematic idea of conformity, but it's kind of how the movie sends a bit of a mixed message regarding if this is actually a completely bad thing too. Because I like how at the end they're saying, like, who are you to tell the human race like what to do, but it's these three people who don't have their lives together at all. It's a guy who works too much and whose family has left him. It's an alcoholic who is holding on to his past and has ruined other people's lives, and it's like this, you know, it's this kind of you know, not stupid, but he's not exactly terribly bright fitness instructor, or rather this fitness freak who doesn't have much in the way of sort of, you know, personal connections either. So there is sort of the idea that maybe, you know, to a certain extent, maybe the alien invasion isn't the worst thing that could happen to the planet Earth, which I like. And I also have to say, what's funny is that, you know, you talk about how the first 45 minutes play so well without it. The movie actually comes really close to ending without the robots. Because
that's a good point.
If you think about it, so, you know, they've been on the pub crawl and they're only sort of half enjoying it. And then it's revealed that, you know, Gary lied about his mother being dead. And in fact, she's still alive. And they're furious at him. And basically they'll leave him and they'll never see him again. But then it almost becomes a good thing for him that they suddenly have this reason to go around.
Yeah.
And to keep going. And it also speaks to the selfishness of Gary King, which I find so great, because the other two movies are about, you know, Shaun in Shaun of the Dead is kind of a slacker, but he means well. You know, he doesn't really want to – he just kind of wants to get along with his life. And Nicholas Angel in Hot Fuzz is, you know, determined to an almost scary degree. And then Gary King is just not only a disaster, but he's sort of a sociopath too.
Oh, yeah. He's totally a sociopath.
I mean,
I was going to say, there's a victory moment in this movie that involves a teetotaling, anyone who doesn't know what a teetotaler is, it's a person who is totally sworn off alcohol. It's basically like being an AA. And there's a victory moment where he just takes 6 shots of vodka. And it's like, that's supposed to be a good thing? Like, there have been whole movies made about the vicious spiral of an alcoholic breaking down and drinking again. And in this movie, it's like a fuck yeah moment.
Well, what's also interesting too is that seeing the movie again, knowing the structure more, the structure is so deliberate and very tightly organized. And I thought to myself that this movie is actually a very large metaphor for alcoholism itself.
Yeah.
Because this is because the thing about, you know, alcoholism is that there are people who know they have a problem and there are people who would like to stop, but they can't. And The World's End, in its third act, basically becomes the story of a man who can't stop hurting himself. Mm-hmm. And he keeps going from one to the other. And it actually became, I thought, really upsetting to watch, as this man is... I mean, the world is basically ending around him, and he can't stop drinking. Like, he has to keep going.
Yeah.
And what I like is that there's only the barest of explanations for it, really, which is that, you know, he says he really has nothing else, because there's his past, which you see in that wonderful prologue, which is sort of lit with this, you know, golden light. And
I was about to say, it's got an Instagram filter on it.
Yeah, and it's very quick and it's very jaunty. And then I mentioned this in my review. I was really sort of shocked when it cuts to that image of him sitting in an AA circle.
Yeah.
And both times I've seen the movie, I've laughed, because it actually is funny how it sort of juxtaposes that. But it's also, you think, it's one of those things, again, like the ending of the previous two movies, you think about it for 5 seconds and you go, holy shit, that's really depressing.
Yeah, and this guy's in AA, he's supposed to be talking about how it's destroyed his life, and instead he's talking about how it's the only good thing that there ever was.
And then what's also funny is that basically there's sort of the sense that much of the action of the movie is actually driven forward by an offhanded comment from the guy sitting next to him, where he says, like, are you sad you never made it to the world's end? And he sort of has this look on his face.
Yeah.
And he gets this smile and he realizes this is something he can still do.
Exactly.
And so that's part of what it's not just that personal connection I have to it, the idea of nostalgia and being back in your old town. It's also just the story of a man who is completely broken and who, again, he can't stop hurting himself. And I don't know. I mean, it was really surprising, and I think that's what makes it the emotion. I think it's by far the emotionally richest of this series.
Yeah, it definitely is, and it felt like a big leap forward for me watching it, because I, like I said, I liked the other ones, but this one seemed to have something more going on, and I really liked that about it until the end. Speaking of which, I think are we ready to get into spoilers
for The World's End?
Yes. For what, Danny? Nick?
Yeah.
All right. So let's get into it. I guess, yeah, we're all saying you should see this, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Just wanted to throw that out there before we moved on. All right. So spoilers for The World's End. The world ends. they follow all the way to the last pub. Two of their mates have been replaced with the blanks, as they are called, because there's a runner about how everyone knows the etymology of the word robot in this world, which is interesting. So yeah, that happens. Two of their mates are missing. It's down to Frost, Peg, and Considine, and they get to the World's End, and they're brought into like the inner sanctum of this, I guess, a spaceship that is posted itself at the bottom, and they speak with an intergalactic consciousness that says that humanity is about to be ushered into the basically like the United Nations of space, I guess,
because Earth is the least civilized, and there's a chart, even,
yeah,
like a pie chart.
It was so weird, like, that it just, like, there was suddenly a PowerPoint presentation in this movie, but luckily it's interesting enough, and it's voiced by Bill Nighy. So that's always awesome, having him there. And but you brought this up, Nick. I mean, Gary King, the least put together man on Earth, speaks for all of humanity, and finally overloads the intergalactic consciousness, and the consciousness just gives up, says it's not worth it, and then I guess detonates. Like, he just decides that, you know, whatever, he's just going to blow himself up, and this causes an EMP blast that destroys all of electronics in the world, this is played as like a return. Like, a lot of this movie is about the past and how everything's better in the past and, like, you know, returning to a simpler time. And what could be simpler than a world without electronics? A world without machines, which will keep people alive when they're in comas, or give them dialysis if their kidneys are failing, or that can diagnose cancer and allow people to be operated on as minimally invasively as possible so that infection is less.
There's a pod that you can go in and it'll cure all your diseases.
Oh, yes. So we don't even know, let's be honest, if that pod ran on electricity.
Yeah.
Well, like, that pod was just a pod. It was just there.
Elysium energy.
So that happens, and we're ushered into the future, which has become like a feudal system again. Picture The Road, but with more Nick Frost, and you have a pretty decent idea of what's going on. But Patty Considine got the girl that he's been in love with since he was a child.
Rosamund Pike.
Yes, Rosamund Pike. They're living together in a small shack. Nick Frost has apparently gotten his family back. And he's the one who's narrating all this, telling the story. And then we find out that Gary King has taken up with the robotic counterparts of his friends as youths. And is now roaming the land, just starting fights and straight up murdering people with a sword. But this is totally fine because he now has the balls to order some tap water from a bar. Which they made a point of earlier. Like, you know, you have to be really secure and okay with yourself to walk into a bar with a bunch of, like, rugby players and order tap water. And so he does it. But of course, it's the future and our entire way of life, and billions have probably died because of the blanks. And so people aren't really fans of these things now, because apparently there was a ginormous explosion, but some of them are still okay. And like, we're supposed to be happy also that, like, the two friends who died have been replaced. And that's, I guess, like, them living somehow. Like, this is an enemy that is literally, they say that they, like, kill people, mulch them, and then use them to grow plants. And that's cool. Like, we're supposed to suddenly think that the blanks are, like, an oppressed minority, and that, I guess, Gary's, like, a righteous king who's helping them to win equality by murdering people in bars.
I mean, I don't know about that last point.
The last point may be me just extrapolating too much. But I mean, like, this is what I'm talking about. Like, I cannot get behind this idea. This, like, you can't make that much of a shift. We've just watched these characters pummel and destroy blanks for the last God only knows how many minutes. And they've murdered two of their friends. And suddenly, we're supposed to feel sympathy and like empathy for these things?
No. No, I don't. I don't think that's the point it's making at all.
You don't.
No.
Because it really seemed like, okay, there's a sign that says like no blanks. Like it's,
yeah,
it's,
I don't think
that's clearly playing on our impressions and historical memories of other oppressed minorities. You didn't pick up on that? Did you? No.
Nick.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, Danny.
You can take this one. Yeah, I was just passing.
Okay. I was going to say
you had to.
No, I was going
to
say I don't think it's mining for sympathy necessarily. I don't think that's what it really is. I think it's actually just sort of a piece of sci-fi world building. I don't know if it's really asking us to feel sorry for these beings. I mean, there's a specific moment where the plight of a blank is played for a laugh when someone throws a quarter inside Martin Freeman's, you know, third size head,
yeah,
or third available head. And, you know, he's like walking into a wall because he doesn't really have eyes.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I think that there's also the idea that the blanks themselves are not really, they're not really bad per se, because if you think about it, nothing really starts with them until Gary actually antagonizes one of them.
Right.
Right.
This is true.
And for the rest of the movie, they're actually being treated, you know, pretty, you know, they're being treated like friendly enough, and
And that's kind of one of the things that I feel weird about with this movie and with Gary's character in general.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause like you said, like they're not bad. Like they don't really want to murder people. Like they're not the creatures from the, what was that movie, War of the Worlds, where they're like using us to fertilize their red plants and stuff.
Right.
Like, you know, they even make a point of saying like, we don't want to kill everyone. Like we want humanity to be intact. We're only replacing enough people to like seed the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But and then Gary starts shit, and then Gary ends shit. And now, like,
no, I mean, I don't, know. I guess I just don't think to myself that this is like a clearly something that is meant to be, you know, I don't think this is really a stab at pathos for the blanks. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, all right. Let's move beyond that. Let's go to the real character stuff. Like when they get to the world's end, they see Nick Frost's character sees the wristband on his friend on Gary, and it's now known that there was like a suicide attempt, and this guy has been living a pretty rough life, and he says that the only time anything was ever good was when they were kids, which is, you know, a dangerous way for anyone to feel, and the movie rewards it.
Okay,
like that's not good.
I mean, it's what I said before. I don't know. I'm not sure how much of a happy ending this movie really has, because the character has a complete reversion to his earlier self.
Right.
And, you know, and the world ends too.
People
are living in a road-esque society, basically because this guy is, you know, a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
But it's funny. That's the thing, is that it's actually pretty funny that his incompetence at seemingly everything but getting drunk has ruined it for everybody else, which is sort of a maximizing of what has been playing out beforehand.
Right. I mean, he is responsible for the near death of his best friend because of his cavalier attitude, and he does that same mistake again writ large over the entirety of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, but he's also, you know, pretty much as happy as he's ever been.
But that's fine for him. But that's like a bad, like you said, it's not a happy ending. It is a bad ending. It is a lose scenario for everyone.
Right,
like that is the lost scenario. This is like, if I can't even think of like any movie about like a person struggling with addiction. This is like if Walk the Line ended with Johnny Cash dying of a heroin overdose, like.
Not exactly.
The only thing that is changed,
I mean, this movie isn't.
Is
I mean, okay, this movie is not anything like Walk the Line.
But I'm saying, saying is, you have a man who's obviously struggling and should be moving towards some kind of catharsis and like a sense of place and being and like an understanding, but instead, like I said, everything collapses to afford him the worst possible good thing that could happen to him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's does that not affect the rest of the movie negatively for you?
No, I don't think so.
I wouldn't have a problem with it, but it really, the movie really seems to make a play at this being like a happy good ending.
I don't know. I mean,
both tonally and structurally, and in the way that we hear Nick Frost talking about Gary, I mean, he's like this kind of like, you know, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know where Gary King is, but I like to think like the guy destroyed humanity. You were pissed off at him when he left you alone in a car wreck. Like, you should have some more problems with him now that he's done this shit.
Well, I don't know. I mean, no. I mean, I think there's also the matter of perspective, too, is exactly sort of their understanding of what happened. Because they really don't understand how this came to pass, even though they were there.
Yeah.
And I think that at the end of the movie, he's come to understand exactly what is wrong with Gary King. And there's much more sympathy there. The sympathy and, you know, the sort of parameters of which permit this forgiveness, even though things kind of went wrong when they were last together. And I think, you know, he wants his friend to be better because he understands now who he is and where he is emotionally. And yeah, I mean, it's a happy ending for Gary King. I just don't think it's a happy ending in general. But I say that as a good thing. When I saw this movie, you know, the first time I saw it, I walked out like really shocked. I went, oh my God, like that's how that series ends. Oh, okay. and I appreciated that feeling. I really liked that. It kind of shook me up a bit. A lot of this movie really kind of shook me up. And, so I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think the ending works both thematically and narratively, but. Maybe does Danny want
to? Yeah, I was about to say, Danny, would you like to finally?
Love that part at the AA session beginning. I haven't really been speaking up because most of my feelings about the ending are just like sheer confusion, mostly around like what that final shot means for Gary King. I feel like the movie took on so many sci-fi concepts that it sort of clouded the character ending for him, for me. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to feel for him in that final shot. And so that was a little bit of a letdown because it does such a good job kind of building up our feelings for him and our interest in him. And then it's sort of, he sort of gets lost with the world, I feel like. And I don't know how I felt at the end. So that was kind of my issue, that like the movie took on so many elements of like sci-fi and blanks, and like the climax of the movie is basically a conversation between like Simon Pegg and a computer god voice, and all this stuff is going on, and I just kind of got lost in the middle of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Love that AA thing. That was...
Well, do we have any final thoughts on this, or have we pretty much talked about everything?
I love this movie, and I sort of love it in a way I don't really... in a way I didn't really expect, I guess. Because I went into it thinking that it was going to be another sort of exactly like... the two films, not exactly like, but much more in line with the two films that come before than what we actually get. And I don't know. I mean, that's a quality I really appreciate, but also I guess what I like is how it still stays true to the series while branching off in new directions. And, the ending's really good. So
I love 99% of this movie, and then the ending baffles me.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't think that there's supposed to be sympathy for the blanks. I don't think it's a happy ending for Gary. Or rather, it's a happy ending for Gary. It's not a happy ending for the movie. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And I think that the blanks are supposed to be sympathetic, and I think that the movie is supposed to have an over-happy ending, and it's really only happy for him. But it's really, really quite depressing, actually. Danny?
So we're actually half there. Reader email. Readers, email. Start clacking away.
If anyone is reading this right now, I will say that you're doing it wrong. You should be a listener.
Oh, right, right. Sorry. Listener email. They can read our. They can read into our words.
Yes. Yeah, if anyone else has a way to look at this ending that maybe we've missed, be sure to email us what your thoughts were, and we'll talk about them on the next one. Danny, your sum up thoughts?
Yeah. Well, just as a general comment on the trilogy, one really promising progression for me is like how much more specific Edgar Wright's characters have become. Because if you look at like Shaun of the Dead, it's pretty like everyday characters, like everyday guy who works in a retail store and everyday couch potato slacker. And then Hot Fuzz, you get a really original character in Nicholas Angel. And Nick Frost in that film is a little bit sort of more mellow. He's kind of like the weak sidekick with the crazy dad. And then in this film, it takes it even further, where Nick Frost is kind of the sane, smart guy, which, you know, Brian, you said you were annoyed by his character in Shaun of the Dead. It's kind of amazing how different it is here. Yeah. And then Simon Pegg is playing like some like goth 40-year-old alcoholic whose comedy is sort of always intertwined with like tragedy. So it's just really impressive to me how he's grown as a creator of characters, because Shaun of the Dead really is sort of like standard prototype roles, and he's gotten better and better with each one.
And also how I think Simon Pegg has grown as an actor too.
Yeah,
because I think he's incredible in this movie.
Yeah, he's really, really good in this film.
In a way that I've never really, I mean, I've always, you know, I tend to enjoy him in movies, but I don't, you know, I mean, like you think of something like Star Trek, or where it's basically like, you know, just sort of wacky Scottish accent running around flowing in water tubes or something. Or, you know, or just most other films, he's funny and, you know, he's likable, but there's kind of, as far as the characters go, he doesn't have as much to play. And then something like Hot Fuzz is sort of intentionally almost a bit one-dimensional. And, you know, Shaun of the Dead just has a simpler progression. But this is so far out from everything else that they've played with before. And I think he completely just nails it. So, yeah, it's hats off to Mr. Pegg. Right. Also, one last thing.
Okay.
Wait, Brian, you saw this. Was the theater, like, crowded, or...?
I saw this at a preview screening, so okay. The theater was packed.
Okay, I wasn't sure, because I saw this at a... when I saw it again yesterday, it was, you know, at a regular mall showing Saturday afternoon, and the crowd really, really liked it.
Mall. Shows.
Why is that funny?
I think it's funny.
It's just the mall.
Why is it funny?
No.
Anyway...
And the crowd just thought it was, you know, quite good. So I don't know what Danny's...
Yeah, what did the crowd think of it?
Yeah, I think they were into it. I was actually kind of, unfortunately, I think I was sitting by like the most distracting members in the crowd. So they were kind of like talking quite a bit. And when they were laughing, I couldn't really tell if they were laughing at the movie or like stuff they were saying to each other. Yeah, so they sort of killed my impression of the overall audience, but I feel like, yeah, for the most part, they were into it, and that it was a good movie to see in a theater.
So that's our thoughts on The World's End, which is out in theaters now. Go check it out. Let us know what you think of it. podcast@thefilmstage.com. We didn't get into it when talking about the Cornetto trilogy, so I just want to touch on it briefly now. Scott Pilgrim. Danny, have you seen Scott Pilgrim?
Yeah.
All right. Well, did you like it?
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, not to just be a broken record, but it sort of goes by that standard with me where, like, I love kind of the first hour, and then when the kind of video game action gets really heavy, I sort of checked out of it. But I do feel like I would like to rewatch it, because that one seems like a sort of almost experimental style where, like, the genre of that movie is sort of, I don't know, just sort of applied in a more ambitious way than maybe the other films. So I'd like to rewatch it.
All right. And Nick Newman, you obviously like this movie quite a bit.
Oh, I think Scott Pilgrim is magnificent. I can't think of any other movie that really so nails sort of the cultural appropriations of a certain generation, rather sort of the 20 to mid-20 set, and sort of the way that the things that we've grown up on have come to inform our lives in very specific, sometimes not healthy ways. And it's also, formally, I think it's, you know, his best film. It's just, I mean, the film I think is exhausting because there is just so much going on in it in any given moment. And, you know, it's hilarious. It has some very good performances. Michael Cera is kind of different in it, which is good. I mean, I like Michael Cera, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I like Michael Cera, but he is, you know, he's actually giving it kind of a different performance here. And amazing soundtrack, too. Wonderful soundtrack. Yeah, I think Scott Pilgrim is a real corker.
A corker. I hate Scott Pilgrim.
Why?
Stand that.
Why?
It's a mess. It's a crazy. I like Edgar Wright. I think that the things that he does in that film are interesting, but it's just it's like out of control and not in a good way. It's not like there's so much and it's almost bubbling over, but he's keeping the plate spinning. It just feels like there was no thought put to overall cohesion. It's just like whatever works in this one moment, we'll do that. Hated the characters. Characters were awful.
Wow.
Scott Pilgrim is by far the least sympathetic, or not even sympathetic, just interesting protagonist that it was in any of these four films. And towards the end, oh my god, like the whole ending is just a jumbled mess that really seems like they were just kind of like, it's like if you're writing a story and you realize that you're at the end and you haven't made a point yet, so you're like, ah, shit, I should just have some dialogue that says what I meant to say, and then...
I mean, the movie makes that point from almost the very beginning, but... Okay.
Wow.
It's not good. It's just a failure. It's not like it's bad in, like, a lazy way. I just think that they failed to connect, like
I think. I think Scott Pilgrim is, like, if not an actual masterpiece, is maybe half a step from it.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
I really do think that. I think it's...
I don't understand how that's possible. You usually have pretty good taste in film.
This is shocking.
And I still do when I'm praising Scott Pilgrim. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that movie I think it's a major, as the kids say. I think it's a major film. I think it's essential.
Is that what kids say?
Yeah.
All the kids.
I mean, how old is Scott Pilgrim supposed to be in that film?
23?
Okay, because I'm pretty sure that, yeah, that came out 3 years ago. So I was 23 when this movie came out. Like, I have real problems with this being a movie that's about my generation. Like, it is not... The things that it's saying are not good or correct, I feel. Like, it's just not good. Like, from its core, the ideas that it's putting out there, the cultural appropriations that it's using, I mean, they're just not, it's just not good.
Well, only if you say so.
What do you mean, only if I say so?
I mean exactly what I mean when I say only if you say so.
Wow.
It's only not good if I say so?
Well, I'm just sort of joking about how you are sort of pushing yourself onto the movie, I think, in unnecessary ways.
But, I mean, that's... You yourself made mention of the things that it has to say about a certain set of people.
Right, and I think you're just sort of... I think this is sort of like when we reviewed Francis Ha, and you talked about how... and you talked about how, like, you didn't identify with the character Francis because you didn't feel she was driven in the way people who... live in Washington, D.C. or driven or something.
I'm saying, the problem with Frances Todd is that she's a completely unsympathetic character.
And you just said that your problem with Scott Pilgrim is that he's a completely unsympathetic character.
Yeah, you can't just put a shitty character out there and have it be interesting because they're not good and they're awful. Like, you should give them some greater purpose. Like, I liked Gary King. Gary King was unsympathetic in his, like, complete and total narcissism and psychopathy, but I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's actors, I don't know if it's writing. I just know that in the case of Scott Pilgrim, I wasn't invested at all. He wasn't someone worth following or being interested in.
Well, he's learning, he's evolving, he wants a romantic connection, which is what the entire film's about. Although you felt that it only made that point in the last 2 minutes, which isn't really great.
It's an evolution from nothing to incipient humanity.
To incipient humanity. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
This is stunning.
What?
Ah, it's
incipient, meaning in an initial stage.
Yeah, I know. I know what incipient, develop. I know what incipient means. It's just it's a new way of putting it.
Your evolution can't be from no character to sort of a character.
I mean, he's a character. He's kind of callous, and why are we having this discussion?
Because it's part of Edgar Wright's filmography.
Yeah, I know, but like, why now? I don't know.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to know, because we've touched on this. We've glanced over Scott Pilgrim previously. I thought it was finally time to air it out. So now that we know that, now that we truly understand where we're coming from, let's move on. Let's do Blu-rays. And DVDs coming to your local stores and Amazon.com and wherever the hell else you can buy films, August 27th. Big releases. Huge releases. We have Pain and Gain.
Sorry, I get very enthusiastic when someone mentions Pain and Gain.
I love Pain and Gain. I will be buying this film.
It's quite good, yeah. I still think about what Danny tweeted after we saw it, that it's Michael Bay's The Tree of Life. Yeah. So.
Okay, so we have Pain and Gain.
Good.
That is obviously a winner for us. We also have The Great Gatsby.
Mm-hmm.
It was a winner for me.
I was a big fan of The Great Gatsby.
I was about to say, you liked it too.
The thing is, I saw it in, you know, a nice projection 3D. I don't think I want to see it elsewhere. I feel like I had a perfect experience with it that one time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there are things I liked it past that, certainly. But on a smaller screen in 2D, I think, I don't know if it would work quite as well. So I'm willing to just let that one experience, that one really great experience kind of sit.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it, because I actually thought the 3D worked really well in that film, and I'm worried that seeing it without it would actually diminish my enjoyment therein.
Yeah.
I probably won't be buying it, but I mean, if you didn't see it, you should check it out, because it was good. We also have Kon-Tiki.
Ooh.
Oh, from the directors of Pirates 5.
Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Wait, is that real?
That's the title of Pirates 5.
No, I mean, they're directing it?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. That's like a joke that came to life.
I think Jerry Bruckheimer never saw the movie. He just saw like the poster and there was a ship and he went, perfect!
Yeah, yeah. There's a ship and a guy's lifting a shark. This is great. Get those guys. Well, that's interesting at least. You know, that makes me a little more interested in that movie. And my interest was it.
I like, shouldn't have told you then.
Yeah. Why, Johnny? Why?
You really shouldn't be thinking about Pirates 5.
Sorry, I know, it's bad. And then we also have Stranded, which is a...
this cover.
Christian Slater, alien knockoff. Oh, yeah. My.
For new releases, just mention At Any Price, which I still really like a lot, and it kind of got swept under the rug.
That's the Zac Efron movie, correct?
Yeah, and Dennis Quaid, and it's sort of a shame because it fits in with all of these movies this year that have been about like the theme of the American dream. So it would have been nice to have some more writing and discussion about it because I think it's very good. and deserves to be kind of in that conversation, but it seems that no one really saw it. So it's a shame.
Oh, man.
There's also Super Buddies, which is looks to be another installment in the dog series of Air Bud.
Oh, my God. Except yeah, Air Bud, and then there's Air Buddies. And...
Except there's superheroes.
Oh, so this is the much-anticipated sequel to Treasure Buddies.
Is this directed by the great Robert Vince? Robert Vince is the guy who directs, like, every... Here, you want me to read a sentence from his Wikipedia page?
I would love you to read a sentence from his Wikipedia page.
Vince specializes in directing movies that feature animals playing sports, such as MVP, Most Valuable Primate, the Air Buddy series, and Chestnut Hero of Central Park.
I've so never did even he, heard of Chestnut Hero of Central Park.
Did he direct Super Buddies?
I don't know. Let me look
yes!
it up.
He did? Yes, he did. Yes.
Wait, I'm looking up Chestnut Hero of Central Park.
I don't know what the market is for these movies.
Little kids, man. They love dogs.
I guess.
Chestnut, Hero of Central Park.
Like, is Robert Vince, like, a happy man? Is he happy with his life? I wonder.
He gets to work with puppies every day.
I wish the guy nothing but the best. I mean, I'm sure he's a nice guy, but I just wonder, like, is this what he wants to do?
I mean, he's made... Ooh, I don't know. Looking at his picture. I mean, like, what I have to think is he's got a steady stream of work. These are things that are all probably pulling a profit because they keep making them.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets to work with puppies. Like, how are you not happy working with puppies?
Yeah.
There are actually two MVP movies. The sequel was Most Vertical Primate.
There's also MXP, Most Extreme Primate.
Oh my God.
Spy Mate. Wow.
Spy Buddies?
No, Spy Mate, I guess. Is it about
Spy Mate, like Primate?
Spy Monkey?
I'm assuming it's like Primate, but it's Spy Mate. Yep, it totally is. Are you looking at this picture?
I'm looking at the Wikipedia page. After Minky exhibited his formidable martial arts skills against KGB agents.
Oh my God.
Mike requested him as a partner.
Wait, no. Are you looking at the poster for it, though?
Let me look. Right. This podcast just went so far off course. Whoa.
Right.
With a young Emma Roberts. So that's where she started.
I'm looking at the poster that's just a monkey in a suit with a gun.
The gun is huge.
It's massive. Maybe it's a banana gun. Anyway, so that's what's coming
there out. Actually, it's funny. There actually are other posters where he's holding a banana like it's a gun.
Oh, Jesus.
So
so that's what's coming out to DVD and Blu-ray. Let's move on. Let's get this. We're taking up way too much of these people's time.
I'm so sorry, everybody listening. I'm so sorry that part of your life is now devoted to us looking at the poster for Spy Mate.
Spy Mate. That's what we're talking about next week. So coming to theaters next week, stuff that may or may not be better than Spy Mate. We have One Direction, This Is Us. It's a Morgan Spurlock directed documentary about One Direction, which is a British pop group. We also have Getaway, a new film starring Ethan Hawke, Selena Gomez, and John Voight. And we then have Closed Circuit.
Which is yeah, there. Closed Circuit.
I don't know. It's got the writer of Eastern Promises, which I liked. It's got Eric Bana, who I like, and Ciarán Hinds.
And like. Rebecca Hall.
Yeah.
Closed Circuit's definitely a movie pass for me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to use it to see it.
I heard
Rebecca Hall, so.
I heard some good things from someone who saw it. So.
All right. Well, that's stuff to check out. Not sure what we're going to be talking about. Yeah. So are we gonna go out on a limb for anything other than Closed Circuit?
Grandmaster is opening wider. I really like the movie. I have a review up on the film stage.
I haven't seen Your Next yet, but I've heard nothing but good things. So I'm
kind of curious about that.
I'm gonna see that sometime this week.
This was a really good weekend for movies because there was The World's End, there was Your Next, there was The Grandmaster, there was Short Term 12.
Yes.
It's the end of August, people. Don't put in the effort.
I was gonna say Ain't Them Body Saints, but apparently
that was last week.
Say that. Well, it's opening wider.
Yeah.
Come on, Nick.
It's widening. It's not just in two markets.
It's of interest. I said that. It's of interest.
Okay. All right, well, let's talk about things we've watched on our own recently, and then we can get out of these fine people's ways. So, Danny King, kick us off.
Happy to.
Good. Do it.
Thanks for asking.
You're welcome.
I had a really awesome movie-going experience this week, seeing a film called Whatever Happened to Baby Jane from 1962. It stars Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, two actresses.
God damn it, and
so the movie begins, and Bette Davis, played by the character at this point is played by a little kid, and she's like a stage star. That's Baby Jane. And her sister, who will grow up to be Joan Crawford, is kind of like sidelined and neglected by her parents because Bette Davis is the stage star. So that's like the opening sequence. Then it jumps forward about 15 or 20 years, and Joan Crawford is a Hollywood star, and Bette Davis is a kind of burnt out alcoholic. So that's the second sequence. And then there's a really mysterious scene where there's a car crash and Joan Crawford has her legs broken. And that's the third sequence. And then the rest of the movie is just the aftermath of them living in a kind of decrepit mansion together with Joan Crawford in a wheelchair and Bette Davis as this alcoholic, jealous sister kind of torturing her. Psychologically and physically. And so it has to be, without exaggeration, probably one of the darkest Hollywood films made. Like, it is just insane. And it was actually showing at Film Forum as part of their kind of sci-fi fantasy series, which is a little odd because it's kind of a drama. But it felt like for the first hour that people were kind of there in the mindset of that series. So a lot of people were laughing at kind of the melodrama. And so you kind of go along with that for a while. But at a certain point, the movie just gets so dark where you like have to stop laughing. And so I don't want to spoil any of it, but it was a really amazing movie. And it's directed by Robert Aldrich.
Man who did The Dirty Dozen.
Yeah, and The Dirty Dozen was actually the first film I saw by him, and everyone I've seen since has gotten progressively darker. There's Kiss Me Deadly, which is just like an apocalyptic noir, completely nihilistic, and then Ozana's Raid, which is probably one of the most violent westerns I've seen. And then this movie, which is just insane. And there's actually a funny anecdote that these two actresses off screen were kind of bitter rivals. And so that's said to kind of inform their performances. And actually, via Wikipedia, Bette Davis was nominated for an Oscar, but Joan Crawford wasn't. Oh, but at the ceremony, the actress who won wasn't there, and Joan Crawford accepted the award on her behalf. And so apparently, like, as she went up to accept the surrogate award, she like went up to Bette Davis and was like, "Sorry, I have to go accept my Oscar," even though she wasn't nominated.
Oh my God.
So I almost, after reading that, I almost wanted to go back and watch the movie again right away, to sort of watch it knowing that they were bitter to each other in real life. But yeah, that's Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
All right. Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Whatever happened to Baby King?
Whatever happened to Gary King?
Whatever happened to BB King?
Anyway.
Yes.
Anyway.
So I'm going to have a very special recommendation for this week. Although it's not the best movie I watched, it is rather good, and I think it's the one most worth noting. It is Twixt. By Francis Ford Coppola, his new film that came out, premiered 2 years ago, only just came out on DVD and Blu-ray last month. On its surface, a sort of horror thriller starring Val Kilmer, but as it turns out, a very personal, very strange, very moving film about an artist struggling to express himself. The movie was lambasted when it premiered. I think on our site, the review gives it like a C- or something. The thing about this film, though, which is very special, is that it completely rejects the typical idea of good style or good taste in order to tell this sort of dream logic driven story. And it is alternately funny, it's kind of creepy, and it's very sad, and it's basically a great film artist throwing all his inhibitions to the wind and making exactly what he wants to make, unafraid of the consequences. And as it turns out, it's a very smart, very interesting film that I am very taken with, especially because in the movie, there's like a group of vampire kids. The movie takes place in a small town, and it's sort of supposed to be the scary kids across the lake who dress up as vampires and dance around and worship Satan. And there's a scene where Val Kilmer goes over there to investigate a murder. And he goes over, and suddenly you hear this song that's sung by Francis Ford Coppola, where it's like this, it's like a goth rap song that goes, "Nosferatu, me and you, me and you, lips of red, eyes of blue." It's in the middle of this movie, and it's completely wonderful. The whole movie is a blast. And if you're a fan of Coppola, and if you have seen his two most recent movies, Youth Without Youth and Tetro, and if you like those, definitely check this out, because it's really exciting how this guy who, you know, was kind of, his career was basically sabotaged by financial ruin, is now making the movies he wants to make again. And, you know, they don't always work. They all have these kind of weird niggling problems to them, but they're fascinating and they're fun. And, Twixt, I gotta give it a big thumbs up.
All right.
So it's, yeah, you can really buy it from Netflix too.
I really want to see that. I kind of want to watch the other two first though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely recommend doing that. If you go into this expecting The Godfather or Apocalypse Now, you'll be horrified. but if you've seen his other movies, and I mean, Danny, you've seen a decent amount of Coppola movies, right?
Yeah, I've been watching several to like get in the mood for it, but there's so many that I haven't gotten to Youth Without Youth and Tetro yet.
Okay,
but
I was gonna say, yeah. If you've seen like One from the Heart or The Outsiders or like Rumblefish, you'll have some idea of what to expect. But it's good to watch his most recent movies, see his digital sort of his digital aesthetic and everything, because otherwise it would be quite shocking.
Interesting. All right. Well, that's something to look for. I watched a film to kind of coincide with The World's End, because I'm a huge fan of Patty Considine. So I watched Dead Man's Shoes. Did anyone ever see Dead Man's Shoes?
No, and I love Considine.
And Shane Meadows, the director, also quite good. It's kind of like a slasher film told from the perspective of the slasher. And it's a ridiculously fantastic movie. And everyone should check it out. I don't want to say too much about what it's about, because half the fun is learning for yourself. So I'm not going to say much about it.
Are there any scenes with pub crawls? Or?
There are scenes in pubs. Does that count?
No, it has to be 12.
Oh, no, we don't get that many.
Has anybody ever seen an English film that doesn't feature a scene in a pub?
Jesus. I don't think
so. I'm just saying. They do enjoy their pubs.
They do like their pubs. All right. Well, that's it for today. Thanks, everyone, for sticking with us. Let us know what you thought. podcast@thefilmstage.com or give us a rating on iTunes. We'll be talking about something next week. We're not entirely sure yet, so tune in to find out the answer to that mystery. In the meantime, here's where you can find us online. Danny King.
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And Nick Newman.
You can find me at TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and The Two-Headed Cock.
Okay. And you can find me at TheFilmStage.com, as well as my personal blog, DearFilm.net, and on Twitter, Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. So thank you,
everyone. Oh, wait a minute. I think it's The Two-Headed... What is the bar called? Maybe not The Two-Headed Cock.
I think it's The Two-Headed Dog.
dog, maybe. Yeah, that's right. Two-headed, the trusty cock. The famous cock?
No, trusty companion.
Yeah, it was the trusty companion. I thought it was the familiar companion.
Oh, the famous cock. That's what it is.
Yeah, I think...
Okay, anyway. That joke went well. So, maybe we should just...
Okay. All right. Thanks, everyone, again. And we'll talk to you next time. Ben Affleck had already proven himself a failure. Is someone blowing their nose into their goddamn microphone?